frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't stop us out and you can't make us run. Those women old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land.
trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
To Shaziz Radio at www.shazizradio.com. Jump over there to the rattle, rattle, clankety clank. Jump over there to the superchat.html. You can talk to all our friends over on the Wake Radio side and the Shaziz Radio side at the same time. And so, I got Thomas on here. How are you doing, Thomas?
All right. I just saw Raymond come online, so I'm going to add him.
Cool.
Unless you say no.
No, yeah. I just
speak now or forever hold your peace.
He's always welcome. Anyway, basically I posted a video in the chat room called How to Destroy a Magnet. And I'd kind of like to talk about that subject a bit. And Stephen Gibbons also pointed to some good links in there. He posted one that looks like it's about using your wood-burning stove and Peltier elements as a generator. And one, free energy is resonance. I think all of them are basically along the same line, so cool.
Hmm.
All right, well, anyway... And good morning to everybody in the chat room, Stephen, and looks like Justin was in here a second ago. What did I just do? There we go. I'm back. I got one of those doggone screens. It's the devil. You can have as many desktops as you want on this thing, I guess. And I just slid my entire desktop out of the way and freaked out. All right, so... Basically, what's the big deal about the whole destroying a magnet deal, you know? What's so interesting about that? Well, from where I come from, I used to be, when I was a kid, I used to take things apart all the time to see how they function, you know? You can tell a lot about something when you dismantle it and look how it all goes back together. You know, sometimes if you take something too complex apart, you may not get it back together. That might be the case in magnets. But anyway, from what I understand, heat is the magnet's worst nightmare, so to speak. So basically, some materials, I guess they call it, what was it, the Curie effect? Is that what we were talking about earlier, Thomas?
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, at certain temperatures, the electrons will align themselves, you know, opposite every other one, whatever. Depending on whatever material it is, depending on the temperature range and so on and so forth. And so I got thinking about this whole deal and magnetic fields and the strengths of magnetic fields and how magnetic fields are actually generated and what exactly is a magnetic field and so on. This one little video sparked off a whole lot of you know, questions in my mind, so to speak, things that if you can figure out what an actual what is actually going on in the magnetic fields that we use to generate electricity, then you can figure out the best ways to utilize those anomalies, is what I like to call them. All right, right now we use essentially a brute force magnetic field to literally shake loose the 29th electron on the copper atom in order to get it to interact with the next one in line. And so with that said, using mechanical force, we're actually able to basically fluctuate that magnetic field or fluctuate a magnetic field through a material and align and unalign copper atoms, if you understand what I'm trying to say. You know, like when the north and the south pole is changing, as it's coming by, it's aligning it one direction, and then as it goes past the other, it flips it back around the other, so we get this fluctuating pulse going on that we call electricity, AC current, DC current, whatever. But if you look inside of a lot of electronics, there's no magnets per se inside of electronics, with exception of, you know, unless they're still using a diaphragm speaker. Most of the modern day speakers are piezoelectrics. So once again, on a microscopic level down inside the piezoelectric, you still have a reaction going on that basically is magnetic. By aligning and unaligning these fields, you get vibration going on. Are you with me so far, man? Or did I just like... Or are we like gone?
Under the bus.
Under the bus. Is Raymond in here?
I'm here.
Oh, cool. Good morning. Anyway, I started looking off this morning for how to simulate a magnetic field. You know, basically make an artificial magnetic field. And believe it or not, when you type in those words, all you get is a bunch of crazy. You get a bunch of animations on how magnetic fields actually function, and it was totally counterproductive to what it was that I was thinking in my mind there.
Don't you love it when you go looking for something, you can't find what you're looking for?
Yeah, it's frustrating. And
especially
so,
if you've ever seen it before.
Yeah. Well,
where'd that go?
That happens a lot around my house. I'll put something where I believe that it's going, where I'm going to remember it, or I believe it'll be safe, or I'll be able to find it again. Inadvertently, I find the best hiding spot for anything that I put in a safe spot.
So when you can't find the hammer, you go look in the freezer?
Yeah.
That's where it's at?
Yeah, it's next to the toaster.
See, you would get it then when somebody's like, I can't find such and such. Have you looked in the freezer?
Anyway, without trying to sound like a babbling buffoon, I stumbled on the heat and magnets, so I threw that phrase in there. How to destroy a magnet, how heat destroys magnetism in a magnet. Mm-hmm. And it's really basically a real simple simple concept that whenever at certain temperatures, the electrons in there will realign themselves. And so essentially what we've been talking about all along is more or less like what we're actually doing with those electrons, aligning them and realigning them. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Steven said, is the Curie effect radiating yourself with radium and polonium? Is that what it says? Anyway, I don't know if I want to be radiating myself with anything right at the moment. Mm-hmm. But no, it's the Curie effect is the temperature at which certain... paramagnetic, diamagnetics, what's the other ones? Doggone it. Hate it when my brain does that. Anyway, we're...
Other one, there's several.
Yeah.
You got ferromagnetic, anti-ferromagnetic, anti-ferrimagnetic, ferrimagnetic. I mean...
Yeah.
This goes on and on.
But either way, it has to do with the alignment at certain temperatures of the electrons inside. And so... One would have to ask that if you raise the temperature of something and it lines the electrons one way, and then you decrease that temperature and it lines the electrons in the opposite direction, I wonder if that could have anything to do with how the actual Peltier element finds those temperature differences and turns it into electricity. What do you think?
It sounds more like you're shaking things around and getting electrons loose, and you've got a diode-like effect that forces it to go the direction you want, like a solar cell. You strike it with light, and the light basically shakes up the diode, and the diode can only allow the energy to flow one direction, like a check valve with heat and pressure in a fluid system.
Not looking at something, and all of a sudden you put your hand down, and it's cold, and you say, wow, that's cold. Then again, the next day you put your head down on something and it's hot, like a stove, an electric stove. You say, whoa! And you move your hand really fast. So when you heat something up, everything in it is starting to gyrate like crazy. And that, there you get your other line, or your disalignment. Okay? So now they're no longer lined up. So if you heat the magnet up hot enough and hold that heat long enough, all the particles get disarrayed so bad you have no more magnitude.
So, we have discovered the secret of the thermal couple and the thermal piles.
There you go.
So, essentially, if you take a thermal couple and you get it hot, it will begin to generate electricity. But there is a point at which that it now will stop generating electricity. It becomes inefficient. And so, the reason why a thermal couple works is because you have two separate materials, one being, like, say, copper, and maybe one being a galvanized metal or whatever. But either way, they have different... points at which the temperature of those metals would have their electrons align. And so at an opposite point, you see where I'm coming from here, guy?
I see exactly where you come from, because I just, the other day, deliberately, absolutely deliberately destroyed a thermopile, a Peltier device. I plugged it into 12-volt and let it heat up with no heat sink. And all of a sudden, it went, whoop, and it, that was it. That was it. It quit working. 360 degrees.
That's a lot of temperature, man.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, you weren't both there on me.
Well, Stephen posted in here, he said, I used to create magnetic screwdrivers by rubbing a magnet in one direction down the magnetism is waving a magnet over it in varying directions. So, essentially, you're aligning the electrons by doing that. Did I lose you guys?
You're aligning the electron shells.
Yeah.
It's like you're twisting all the atoms around. That's what I said before. It's all down to, like, if we could find something that its natural crystalline state that it likes to return to was also a magnetic field that it would create, then we would have something that when you heat it up, it would just instantly become magnetized.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to.
Right, you'd have to basically do some disorganizing on purpose and then freeze it in that disorganized state to keep it from being magnetized.
There's a metal out there, I can't remember the actual name of it, but they call it memory metal. And whatever shape that you bend this at such, like I think it was 500 degrees, whatever shape that you bend this at, when you cool it down, it will flatten itself about right back out. And then whenever, now it's vice versa. Doggone it.
There's several different kinds and they all have different temperatures that they react to. And there's more than one temperature in that system. You reach it to one temperature, you can bend it and leave it like that when it cools off, and when you heat it up again, it'll bend back to its original shape. But if you heat it up over a certain point, then you can actually change its quote-unquote original shape so that it will then return to that new shape.
Yeah.
The thing is, when you, like Thomas said, when you get at a certain temperature, you can bend it and it'll stay there. But when you reheat it, heat it up to like the boiling point of water, it not only returns to its original shape, but it returns with a vengeance. I mean, like,
what I heard, back.
1 ounce of that memory metal, when it returns with over 40,000 pounds of force.
It's kind of like flops back like a spring.
Uh-huh.
Nightingale, there it is.
That's it.
Anonymous 004 gets the credit for that one. I couldn't remember what it was, Nightingale.
Yeah, there's also something called muscle wire that when you shock it, it actually contracts at a certain voltage. Whenever you push the amount of current and voltage even higher, it'll relax. And a bundle of that stuff that's only an inch in diameter has thousands and thousands of pounds of lift. The problem is, though, it takes a tremendous amount of length of it to basically move just contract or expand even an inch.
Well, I was looking at a toy just yesterday, and essentially it was like a little deal like a fish tank. And it had a fish inside there that was hanging from a string, which I'm pretty sure either had a little magnet inside there. Then it had a little solar panel on there. And so when the sun's shining on there, it has a little coil that pulses and causes this thing to wobble back and forth. That don't sound like a whole lot. But that little concept, and the concept that you're talking about right now, I can see potential. Can you guys see what I'm trying to talk about here?
I do.
So, those have you ever seen those little bobblehead toys, that the little dancing toys that they have in the stores, the little solar toys?
Yep.
Those things, They're pretty impressive for their size. I would like to see somebody do the actual math on, from that scale. If you scale that up, what it would take to actually build a full-size version of that. I'm kind of getting along the lines of the same thing as your drinking bird, which also has the Curie effect going on in there as well. Am I correct?
Yep. My drinking bird that I built that was 9 feet tall worked. Just worked slow.
Well, for what it is that drinking bird's doing, it's basically heating up and that gas is expanding and going down the other. Can you explain that again, how that actually is functioning? I can't seem to find the words for it.
Okay. The body of the bird contains a fluid that has weight that will evaporate at low pressure. As you heat the body, then the pressure builds and the tube goes down to the bottom of the body but does not touch the bottom. So consequently, the pressure pushes down the liquid, causes it to go up the tube until it gets to a point that it's overbalanced, and then the bird dips down into the water. Now the head of the bird is covered with felt. Okay? So now all of a sudden, when it dips down in the water, the tube that's going down into the body is out of the liquid, and the liquid in the tube runs back down into the body and pulls the head out of the water. Now the head, being covered with felt, sucks up the water, and now the bird's walking back and forth, so it cools the gases that were heated that caused the pressure that pushed down the liquid to cool and shrink. As they cool and shrink, the body is being heated up again, and the process is just back and forth and back and forth. Actually, you do not even need water. If you cover the head with tinfoil or something that would reflect sunlight and painted the body black so it would soak up the heat from the sun, it would operate in the sun just as well as it does in the water. Sorry.
Cool. So I'm seeing a common denominator in a lot of the different projects that we're talking about as far as heat and magnetism are going, the way things expand and contract, and like hot air rises and cold air falls, and gases will expand and contract, or even solids will expand and contract due to temperature differences.
Oh, whoa, you just said a secret right there. It's a heat engine. Heat engine does not work on heat. It works on a difference in temperature.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to get at, is that if you can destroy a magnet with heat, and I don't necessarily think that it's permanently destroyed, if you could realign those and cool it back down to the temperature that it was at, like whenever the magnet was still magnetized.
Okay. I and Muddy together took some neodymium magnets, heated them up, and they lost their magnetism. Now we heated them a little bit, and they lost their magnetism. We took the heat away and waited 30, 40 minutes, and the magnetism came back and realigned itself. However, if you heat it up really hot for a period of time, you permanently destroy the magnetism. But then if you reheat them up again and place them between two other magnets, they will realign themselves and cool them off slowly. They will totally come back.
So essentially when they're heated, then they're in a kind of a, not a, like a visible liquid state, but basically everything's looser inside there, right?
Everything's jumping around because it's so daggone hot.
Yeah.
It's like you, going barefoot, walking across the hot sand on the beach. I mean, you're dancing and jumping and carrying on, and all of a sudden you get that cold water and say, oh, wow.
Well, Justin was telling me quite some time back about how they were heating their water over there in his church over there in Canada, by spinning magnets past copper tubing or copper plate or something like that. And I got to thinking about how the temperature, if the temperature got hot enough, would it eventually mess those magnets up in that system? But after listening to what you just said, you could actually put some extra magnets on the cold side of the deal, or, you know, an area where maybe you could designate as a cold side, where basically those when those hot magnets were coming through there, they would realign the magnetic field on the opposite side. You see what I'm trying to say here?
Yes, you can take a magnet, deindimmed magnet, heat it up to 400 degrees for 2 or 3 seconds, and it won't hurt it, because you're going to cool it. But if you heat it up to 400 degrees for 20 minutes, you're going to destroy all the magnetism. So if you had, say, 200 magnets on a round wheel, and you started turning that wheel over a copper pipe with water in it, the copper pipe is going to get hit 200 times. Every time that wheel goes around, the pipe is going to heat up, but the magnets are not going to get destroyed.
Okay, I was just trying to look at whether or not any radiant heat would actually make it off of that copper pipe and cause any destruction, but I think
yes, Justin, it would.
Justin just typed in that they go cold.
Uh-huh.
I've always been fascinated with that. Since I've seen the first video where the guy was using a really high RPM motor to actually, you know, cause that, what is it, that eddy currents that they call it, that's actually causing that.
Right.
Anyway, so heating up a magnet can destroy it, bringing it back down to the temperature, and in the process realigning the deals can actually repair it, is what you're saying.
Okay, look, let's just say you take a torch, alright, and you put it on the magnet, you hold it there, the magnet's going to heat up, but yet you can take your hand and pass it across that flame really fast, and your hand is not going to heat up. Are you understanding what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, that's pretty much, I guess, what Justin just said.
Uh-huh. So if you take a lot of magnets on a round wheel, and you pass them over one spot that the magnets attract or repulse, the magnets are not going to get, they're not going to get any effect. The object will. It will receive several blows. It's like you're taking, have you ever taken a hammer and hit a piece of steel with it? And just over and over and over again, as fast as you can. Next thing you know, that piece of steel is going to get hot. And so is the end of the hammer that you're hitting the steel with. But if you took two hammers, one in each hand, and start hitting the exact same spot over and over and over real fast, the hammers will get warm, but the steel is going to get hot. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you pass a magnet across a piece of copper, you're going to get effect. But you don't use the same magnet, but you do use the same piece of copper pipe. And in that copper pipe, you have water. So all of a sudden, the copper pipe's going to start getting hot, and it's going to heat the water. But the magnets are going to stay cold because they're passing over it once every 2 seconds or 3 seconds, or if you have enough magnets and the wheel big enough, once a minute. But the copper pipe is going to receive hundreds of blows a minute.
Well, I guess the key to this whole conversation is understanding the doggone how the lining and the realigning of the electrons inside there, or the shell of the electron or whatever, is actually producing our electricity. We know that we can take a Slayer exciter circuit, like a 9-volt battery, and we can generate high voltage, high frequency with that battery. So we're actually getting a magnetic field that's basically synthetically created as far as from the power source side. Now, on the opposite side, the magnetic field would be from whatever copper wire There's like 29 electrons in the copper atom, and the 29th is loosely coupled, and it's the one that's wobbling back and forth, interacting with the other ones, creating a stronger magnetic field. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how to actually produce a solid state version with no moving parts, just kind of like almost like the way the inverters work. I'm not 100% positive there isn't something inside the inverter moving, like a relays or whatever. You see what I'm saying? I think I lost you there.
Yeah, you did.
Anyway, to be able to I keep trying to say artificially create a magnetic field. Right now, all we're doing is fluctuating magnetic fields to get the current flow that we want. And if you could artificially create a magnetic field, you know, like how everybody's kind of looking for how to build custom magnets and monopole magnets and being able to basically control the north and south field of that deal. The pulse motors are a pretty good example, because you set the magnets on your pulse motor to whatever north or south, and then the coil you can adjust to being the same field by the direction that you put that coil on there. So you actually got the equivalence of a monopole magnet, even though it's an electromagnet, if you understand what I'm trying to say here.
I do that one, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Basically, if you can build a strong enough magnetic field to do the same work that the brute force magnetic field in our generators is what I'm trying to get at. Once you know how the magnetic field is actually functioning, how the magnet itself, there's materials inside that magnet that are aligned. Well, you got a north and a south pole, so what's that mean on that magnet? There's two different alignments going on in that magnet, or what?
Thomas was talking to me a couple times here in the past 2 or 3 weeks, and he said something about motors that have metal in the center of their copper coil. And as the magnet pulls over, it's coming across the metal, it causes an increase in the magnetic flux that goes through the copper coil. But if you turn the motor too fast, then you don't give the time, you don't have the time for the magnetic aligning of the particles in the metal to readjust.
Yeah, and it's when they flop back, that's when you get that either attraction or repulsion because of that metal.
I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah.
So
essentially, the only thing the core is actually doing is acting like a flip-flop switch. And so...
Thomas was trying to say.
Yeah, and so that actual flux wind turbine that Muddy has been making, it's got magnets on both sides, but it also has those metal rotors on each side. And so you're strengthening that field in two different directions.
Right.
And you're basically hitting that from both sides.
But he does not have a metal core inside of the copper coil.
No, but the magnets are fighting, with each other. They're both on the same pulse as far as north to north or whatever. They're facing each other.
Right.
But the metal across from the whichever set of magnets is on whichever rotor is doing the same thing. It's aligning the electrons on one side and then realigning them on the opposite side, so you're getting that flip-flop back and forth, but at a stronger rate because of the way that it's designed.
A lot stronger.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm trying to figure out how to actually make a that same effect using solid state like transistors, resistors and stuff like that. We know we can flip-flop that field with a transistor. All you're doing is turning it on and off, turning that You know, you're starting off with electricity and creating a wave which is interacting with the material.
And I'm starting to see what you were talking about that I didn't understand.
Yeah.
The different materials do different things under different situations. Now, a transistor turns things on and off, and they make transistors that will do it at different rates of speed.
Yeah. Transistors and MOSFETs, all they are is really super fast acting switches. That's it. There's not no different. I mean, you can do the same thing with just touching a wire on something, you know?
Right. Do it by hand.
But you can't do it as fast as that switch or that transistor.
And the transistor is made of different material, not skin and bone and muscle that have to be excited to move your switch back and forth, back and forth, so you can actually get a transistor that will turn something on and off 400 or 500 times a second.
Yep.
You can't do that manually, but you can use another material and cause it to do it, right?
Yep.
Okay.
So basically, we need to run an electric motor. Let's just say a 110 motor at 60 hertz or whatever, 110, 120 at 60 hertz. We got to have that speed of whatever rotor is turning. And the fluctuation of all the different magnets inside that rotor to be timed out so that it comes out to a 60 hertz frequency. Well, we can duplicate that or replicate that using an inverter taking 12 volt DC and having the inverter send that wave out the other side. You see what I'm saying? So you can still get that strength of the magnetic field enough to run a AC motor on the other side, or a DC motor, whichever you like. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. You know, it was back in the mid-60s that they made a little device that you could actually hook into your alternator on your car, because your alternator had diodes and crap in them. They put out, it was an alternator. It made alternating electricity, but they had diodes that made it DC, direct current, which charged your battery. But then all of a sudden they come out with this device that you could put in your truck, and if you idled your truck up to a certain, you hook it up to the alternator, and it would take that DC, direct current, and not make it AC, but it would make it pulsating DC. Therefore, it would run an AC motor.
Yeah.
It would run any heating element, such as an incandescent light bulb or a toaster. And it was amazing to me, because if you took a 110 volt motor with brushes and run it on DC, it would run, but very slowly. But if you run it on pulsating DC, you could run it just as fast or slow and not burn it up. If you took AC current at, say, 60 or 70 volts and put it in a 10-volt motor and put a load on that motor, you would burn it up. But with pulsating DC, you can use 25 or 30 volts, and it would not hurt the motor at all, not one bit.
Have you done any experiments on to find out where the actual temperature, the sweet spot of the Peltier elements are? You know, there's got to be at some point from 0 degrees all the way up to the maximum temperature before it destroys itself. But somewhere in that middle is a happy medium to where it is its most efficient, where it's producing as much as it can under the circumstances.
Yes, I have. I just did it about 3 days ago, and I think I've mentioned it earlier today on the show, that now they're different with Peltier devices, okay, because they're made of different materials, but the ones I was using, at 360 degrees, it destroys itself.
So that means the metal at that, or the materials inside it at that time, starting to break down because of the heat. See?
Exactly.
Now, if there was a way to give that Peltier element the temperature that it needed, And to be able, see, resistance is what actually creates the heat. Is when you're trying, like in a silicone chip, when you're trying to shove a bunch of data or whatever through there, essentially you're shoving electric waves through there, and the resistance of basically slowing it down is causing it to heat up. So there's got to be a sweet spot to where you can run something cool but still get what you want out the other side, if you understand what I'm trying to say here.
That's the thing. If you don't get the heat off, it will destroy itself, and that's exactly why the one that I destroyed did deliberately. That's why it did get destroyed. I was not drawing the heat off of it. Now, the next experiment is to draw the heat off and see how hot it will get.
Alright, so...
It's not hotter than 360 degrees before it destroys itself. But if I can get the heat off before it reaches that temperature, then it will last forever. So, yes, you're the sweet spot.
Okay, so my next question on the Peltier element portion of it, have you tried yet to put a couple of those Peltier elements back to back where there, you know, there's a hot side and a cold side on one of it, right?
I did try that about 2 years ago, and I got no results at all. I don't know. I could have done something wrong, but it seems like it would work. But the way I did it, it didn't.
Well, let's say one of them you're energizing, so one side of it's going to get hot and the other side's going to get cold. So that's going to be, you know, like when you're using it for your igloo cooler or whatever.
Right.
Well, that one side that's get hot, you need to take that heat away from it to make sure that it doesn't get too hot where it ends up destroying itself. And actually, when it gets hotter, correct me if I'm wrong, it'll start drawing more... drawing more juice trying to get.
Well, you know, I'm not going to correct you because I don't know if you're wrong, but I'm going to tell you this. I did stack three of them together. I painted one side black and the other side I put light cube on it. I took it out in the sun and I got no results at all. None. So maybe I just didn't do it right. Maybe I didn't have enough heat. I don't know.
Maybe you had the wrong side of the Peltier element. I like there's got to be one for the cold and one for the hot.
Excuse my French, but I half-assed did my experiment. I didn't really, you know what I'm saying? I was just playing around, okay? Now that I have about 300 and some Peltier devices, I think I will experiment with that a little bit farther.
Well, because the reason why I was saying is that you know, you got to put a heat sink on one side to take away that temperature. Now, if you're putting heat to it, there's got to be a point where you got to back that heat off before you end up destroying it as well. But I'm talking about, like, if you're using one as a generator device, you know, you're basically using it to generate the heat that you're going to heat the next Peltier element up, and then the one next one in line has to be cooled down. If there was a way to take that heat energy from that point and put it back into the system, if you understand what I'm trying to point out here, to make it as efficient as possible, same reason why we were doing what we're talking about with the motor.
Well, I hate to do this, but I'm going to have to back out of here. Larry just came in, and we're going into Boomtown Laboratories and work on the vapor carburetor.
Got any new videos up on that one?
I've got one video up so far, and it's showing the heat transfer muffler that we made for 6.5 horsepower Honda motor. And it's loaded with 120 Peltier.
Yeah, I saw that one there. I think we actually posted a link in the chat.
The thing is, it's a heat engine. And the heat engine does not work on heat. It works on a difference of temperature. Now, the Peltier device, if you heat it up, it will make electricity. No, it will not. You've got to get the heat off as fast as you put it in. Now, we're getting a lot of electricity. I mean, like 70 or 80 watts off this kind of bigger thing. Okay?
Cool.
But the only way we can do it is to cool it with a fan. But the fan draws more current than it's making. So it also, it dawned on me, this heat transfer muffler with sulfurial devices would be absolutely fantastic in the winter time. The Ormond automobile, because in the winter you would have a great difference. The muffler will not get any hotter in the winter than it will in the summer. But in the winter, the temperature is a lot colder, so the difference in temperature will be a lot greater. Therefore, it will create a lot more electricity. But then again, you're running down a highway, cooling it even faster. Yes, the Pelferro device on a muffler in the winter would be excellent. In the summer, no. Not worth its time. Not worth its effort.
What if you used... What they use in that, and pretty much the same process in AC, you know, air conditioning, basically, where you're expanding a gas and blowing it across that, and you know, you're heating up the gas from one side, and then you're allowing it to go around and condense and, you know, back into its gas state on there. You see what I'm saying, to where you get that cooling effect?
I think you're getting it's a tiny bit backwards. You're taking the gas and you're compressing it down to a liquid.
Yeah.
And by doing so, you're compressing, you're condensing the heat so that the actual temperature is greater. Therefore, it dispels and goes off into the atmosphere better. And then when you release it and it turns back into a gas, that gas is cold. It's like your air in your air compressor. I use air a lot. Especially if I'm trying to drill large holes with the cup saws through compound wood substances such as OSB, whatever, you know, any type of plywood, any type of wood that has glue in it. When you're cutting it with a cup saw, it gets hot. The glue melts, it gums up the teeth. I use air. I pump my air compressor up to 150 psi. I wait until the tank is cold, or room temperature rather. I'm sorry. Then when I release that air, it is ice cold, and I use that air on my cup saw teeth, and I just keep bumping it so it doesn't build a great heat, but yet it keeps blowing the sawdust and the glue out and keeps the teeth cold.
So since the summertime, the doggone heat outside is going to be pretty hot. You don't think that it's going to be able to cool it down enough to...
At the point of the muffler, it is roughly 500 to 560 degrees, which that would destroy the Pelferro device, but I've got heat sinks on it. Now, with no air, the Pelferro devices aren't making a lot of electricity, but they're not being destroyed either, because the heat sinks are drawing the heat off, but not fast enough. So if you put air on it and put a fan and blow it across the heat sink, then it takes the heat off the Pelferro device faster. I've said it a thousand times on the same show, over and over and over again. Heat engines do not run on heat. They run on a difference in temperature.
Yeah.
The greater the difference, the faster you can get the heat out of that engine, the better it will work. Therefore, a Pelferro device is a heat engine. It runs on a difference of temperature, not heat.
Yeah, I agree. But basically what I guess I'm trying to get at is there's a... using that heat, there's got to be a way that you can use the force of that heat energy to actually create a cooling effect to start cooling down that exhaust before it gets as hot as it normally does.
It sounds like you're trying to pack more cooling effect into less area. You probably need to go the other direction and just use bigger heat sinks that can dissipate that heat at a higher rate into the
right
into the warm air.
Right.
So,
but it ain't that it can't be done. It's just that we got to figure out a material that can withstand and basically bring away that doggone heat as fast as possible.
Yeah, and the sixth thing is, if you're a salesman, you don't try to sell air conditioning to an Eskimo, okay? All right. What I'm trying to say is, a hammer is great for driving nails. not worth a hoot when it comes to threading the pipe or screwing pieces of pipe together.
So,
the right tool for the right job at the right area is like you said yourself. You don't build a house out of straw in Tornado Alley.
So a thermoelectric boat might not be out of the question?
Nope. Wouldn't be out of the question at all.
So you'd basically like have a Peltier element with the heat source on the top, and then you'd have water at the bottom being cooling the Peltier element down. That's the temperature difference.
I want to correct myself. I agreed with you. Because all of a sudden I was thinking about a boat and water, and then all of a sudden I realized I'm a salesman trying to sell an air conditioning conditioner to an Eskimo. Wait a minute, what if that boat you're talking about was in the desert? Wouldn't go anywhere, would it?
Well, who takes a boat to the desert?
All right, now we're talking. And we're talking about driving a nail with a pipe wreck.
No, I'm talking about if you're on a lake.
It'd work better.
If you're on a lake, is the temperature difference of that water going to be enough of a temperature difference from whatever heat source you got on the other side to actually put enough energy out to actually drive an electric motor?
Exactly. Yes, it would.
If you have 500 degrees at one point and you've got normal air temperature outside, that's even if it's 100 degrees in the sun, you've got enough temperature difference there. You just don't have enough pulling power to pull that heat that's coming off of those peltiers through natural convection. That way you don't have to use the fans.
Exactly.
You just need bigger heat sinks.
Well, I'm going to have to buy
maybe
me
maybe better material. You know, make them out of copper. Don't make them out of aluminum.
I'm going to have to buy me up a bunch of different Peltier elements and see how far I can actually push those little gizmos, man.
Don't have to buy anything. All I got to do is get your address. You got to keep losing it. I'm going to send you some.
Well, I want to see how far they can actually be pushed. You know, and I'm not talking about to the point of destruction, but I'm talking about temperature differences with natural, heat, sunlight, water temperature. There's a water difference between the sun. So if let's say, for instance, you got one Peltier element on one side stuck on the bottom of a aluminum bottom boat, right? And then you have the top of that Peltier element painted black with heat absorbing paint. And so when the sun's beating down on that, how much electricity is it actually going to produce? Is it going to be enough to actually turn a small electric motor to produce enough thrust to actually move that boat?
Okay.
We know that a solar panel can do it.
All right. So here's the thing. The destructive temperature of a Peltier device is directly proportional to how fast can you get the heat off the other side.
Well, I understand that, but the temperature difference...
You can heat a Peltier up on one side to... I said I destroyed one at 360 degrees, but you can actually heat it up to 500 degrees without destroying it if you can get the heat off the other side of it that fast.
Well, imagine you got a heat sink poking through the bottom of your boat.
What I'm saying is, what if you put a Peltier device on a piece of dry ice, and all of a sudden you hit it with a 1,000-degree flame from a torch? You're not going to destroy it. It's how fast can you get the heat off. It's the temperature difference, and how fast can you get that difference, neutralize that difference. How fast can you neutralize it?
Yeah. Well, I can see plenty of ways to get the heat away from it. But,
I can't. I'm sorry. sometimes I'm a little bit dumb. Ignorant. I don't know how to get the heat off as fast as I can put it on. I put the heat on something so fast it'll melt and run like water. But I can't get that heat off as fast as I can put it in there.
I'll have to look at your video and see what the heat sinks you have are like. Because I got a couple boxes full of them.
Yeah.
I'm playing around with all different sizes of heat sinks, and I've found that if you put a heat sink that's three times the size of the original heat sink, you're not getting three times the amount of heat that's pulling out of it. You have three times the void
Right.
But you actually have more than three times the surface area. And that's how quickly it's dissipating it into the air.
Right.
Well, inside...
That's why a heat transfer muffler with ductarial device in the wintertime on an automobile that's driving down the road will work fantastic, but not in the summer.
Inside the internal...
I was going to say, in the summer, you need a bigger heat sink because... The temperature difference, basically it's like the temperature difference between, or I should say the pressure difference between pouring something off of, I guess a ledge in normal atmosphere and having a vacuum on the other side and pouring something off that ledge.
Right.
If there's a vacuum there, it's going to suck it into it a lot faster. So, and that cold is basically a vacuum. It's
right.
A vacuum of heat.
Inside the internal combustion engine, in order to pull that heat away fast enough, they have a water jacket on there. You know, there's air-cooled motors
right.
that just...
Yeah, water is basically just a better conductor. That's all.
No,
if you fill it up, though, you don't have anywhere to get rid of it. It's going to get too hot. It's still the engine's still going to overheat.
I'm glad you guys brought this up because I had the exact same thought. I'm thinking about taking the transfer muffler and put it inside of something else.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at. Water jacket.
Yes, water jacket.
Right. If you don't have a big enough tank, though, to with fins and whatnot on it to dissipate the heat, again, into the air, though, from that
again, right. Now, here's the thing, is what this is, and starting this whole radio show, Bad Science, about. If you can't find free energy, you're just not looking for it. And he's right. Energy is energy. It is there. You can use it over and over and over again. Now, for example, the heat transfer muffler. You're burning gasoline, which is stupid, in an internal combustion engine. If the engine is turning a generator or an alternator, making electricity. But in burning, it's getting really hot, so you take the exhaust, you run it through a filterial device, and it makes more electricity. Now, all of a sudden, it's not making electricity because it's so hot, and you can't get the heat off the filterial, so then you put a water jacket on it. Now, all of a sudden, you're heating water and making electricity, but what are you going to do with the hot water? You're going to run that over to a Stirling engine, and you're going to run it and make more electricity. You can use energy over and over and over again and never destroy it.
Finally, we got to my point.
Exactly, Shazam. Exactly. And people out there that, I don't know, I haven't heard your naysayers, but you talk all the time about naysayers that call you stupid. You're not stupid. They are the ones that are stupid.
Finally, we got.
It cannot be destroyed, but it can be moved from one spot to another in a different form, and in that form can be used for something else, and in doing so, you're going to change its form again to something else, and when you do, you can build another device that will use that form of energy. I mean, come on.
We try to find all these methods by which to basically cool something down so that it doesn't destroy it, either the magnetic field or the magnet or the materials, whatever it is we're running, like the internal combustion engine. Even when you have a radiator on there, and even when the fan's blowing on there, you'll notice that during summertime, your car is going to get a lot hotter than it would normally do during the wintertime. The wintertime has a better capability of exchanging that heat out into the air, but even in the wintertime, you wouldn't want to touch your exhaust after running your car.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a lot of power. So we're trying to figure out ways like to preserve the Pelletier element so it don't destroy itself, but we got to be able to get that energy away from it fast enough in order to keep it from destroying itself and making it its most efficient. So what that's telling me is that we're producing more energy than we want because we got to figure out a way to get rid of the waste.
Uh-huh.
That's what I've been trying to...
Yeah, but the thing is, we want to recycle. Everybody wants to recycle. Recycle. Oh, let's go green. What are they talking about going green?
Let's just plain recycle the same energy over and over again. It can be done.
Yeah.
It can be done.
And so, you know, it basically with electricity, you get resistance from a small pipe as opposed to a large pipe. A large pipe, you can get a lot of flow. All right? And so right now, it's in a closed-loop system where that radiator and the water and the heat is being dispersed into the radiator. And so now you're relying on a closed-loop system to try to disperse heat rapidly. Now, what would happen if you could keep a continuous water flow going on there and have that radiator literally wide open so that basically all the heat and everything can escape out the top of the radiator? Now, you're going to be pumping all your water out the top of your radiator. However, you're going to move that heat away from the engine so rapidly. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
So you're wide open in the air. While it's going to take you more water to keep it cooled down, the more water you pump through there, the faster that water moves at it away from it, and it's not in a closed loop system, so it's basically going out into the atmosphere is what I'm trying to say. You see where I'm getting at? It's like the difference between a small heat sink as opposed to one of the really tall heat sinks with a fan on it. Your surface area, man. The same thing applies.
That's what I was trying to get at. Surface area is the important thing.
Yeah.
It sounds like if you're spending more energy to move that air to cool that thing off, you don't have enough surface area.
So, if your car or your exhaust was designed with basically built-in heat sinks underneath there, basically, if you could visualize what a heat sink looks like, but one shaped the size of your muffler, and in between there with sandwiched Peltier elements, you would get the same heat exchange that you would for, like, I got a Bobcat, and it's air-cooled. It doesn't have a radiator on there, but it can withstand those temperatures to a certain extent. You know, when you're not dogging the heck out of it, but it's all air cooled because of those big fins on the side of it. Now imagine your exhaust having huge fins with those Peltier elements, so now you got more surface area for that heat to be able to escape into the atmosphere. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, and I also see what Thomas was saying earlier. Just because you increase the surface area three times, doesn't mean you're going to get three times the cooling. Yeah.
No, because those those air-cooled motors are reliant on my Bobcat, it has a rotor that has fins on it that when that engine's turning, it produces a vacuum, blows air up inside there across that motor. That's where it gets its cooling from.
All right. Now, wait a minute. Thomas just turned his camera on and showed me a heat sink that looks like roughly 5 inches by 6 inches and really large fins on it, and that would pull a lot of heat off of something, except for one thing. The Peltier devices that I've got are 1/5 by 1/5 inch. So there again, he's got a lot of surface area, but the heat is in one small spot. I mean, do you see what I'm talking about?
Right, you're putting them too close together, I guess. Right. You need a block that basically leads up into a bigger block that's got bigger fins on it.
Right. You need a large area,
something like this.
Yes, there
you go. A block underneath it that's like that, which I have some that are like that. They're made basically to reach down inside of a socket to get to the back of a chip.
Right.
And then it's basically just a big block that they milled off the surface area to make a little block sticking out of a bigger block. So it's like a peg sticking down in there. And
we got Thomas is, I'm seeing what, you got your camera on and I can see what you're talking about, but the listeners cannot.
Right.
So we need to describe it a little bit different. Yes, that is a beautiful heat sink.
If this were made out of a piece that were, like, say, this long and then milled off on the side so that it would fit down into a smaller area to fit that, then it would work. Because this portion up here, that surface area, is what determines how quickly you're going to be able to dissipate the heat into air that's just sitting on it.
Right.
No fan blowing over, just sitting on it. Because as the air heats, it's going to start moving on its own.
Thomas, you need to make a video of what you just said and what you showed me, so the and put it on YouTube so we give the listeners a link so they can see what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, imagine taking that same exact heat sink, and that would actually be the water jacket if it had an outer shell on it.
Right. Okay, now, the water jacket would be like putting a fan on it with air.
Yeah.
Except water would probably heat off better than the air.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. You just need essentially a transfer device. You need
transfer. Exactly. Yeah. Better get the heat off. Now, what are you going to do with this hot water?
Well, what do you want to do with it?
We're running a gasoline engine to turn an alternator to make electricity. Now, we're trying to take the heat from the exhaust and make electricity. Now, in order to do that, we're going to heat up some water. What are we going to do with the hot water? We're going to put a radiator, put a fan on it, and blow the heat away? Or are we going to take that hot water and put it to heat up a Stirling engine and make more electricity?
Or how?
And what are we going to do with the heat that passes through the Stirling engine?
How about?
It does not work on heat, it works on different temperatures.
How about when that water is going, when that water is going through there and basically gets hot, and then it goes out and basically begins to turn into steam because it's pulling so much heat away from it. You use that as that steam is recondensing for an evaporative cooling that you can use for AC.
Yep, exactly.
So basically what I'm trying to point out is unlimited potential. You're taking all kinds of waste away from it. You know, when you're running the internal combustion engine, they say that there's no such thing as over unity. But if that's the case, then why do we have such destructive forces such as heat that we got to figure out ways to get around so we can run this doggone motor at 120 miles per hour if we want?
Like I said, it's the job you're doing. What are you doing? Okay. What tool do you need? You got a toolbox full of tools, but you don't have a hammer. And you need to drive a nail. What are you going to do? Let's do a screw. And a drill. I mean, come on, folks. Hang on, man. I'm trying to say, Shaziz is absolutely 117.5% correct. You cannot destroy energy. However, you can use it if you use the right tool. Now, once you've used it, are you going to throw it the excess of weight? No, you use it as well. The heat off the back of your air conditioner can make electricity. And feed that electricity right back into your air conditioner and drop your electric bill.
So essentially, if you're running an electric motor, and this is the reason why I wanted to bring up the magnets and how they get destroyed and how a magnetic field and how the at different temperatures, the Curie effect, that how the magnetic field will actually, the electron shells will realign themselves and you lose your efficiency. So imagine an electric motor that could not, under any circumstances, ever get hot. You see what I'm saying?
No.
Well, the magnetic field is always going to be working when that engine, when that electric motor is cool. All right. The electric wire in that motor won't get damaged because the wire won't be able to get it hot enough to actually cause the breakdown in the insulation in the wire. So you can't burn the coil out.
Wait a minute. Are you saying the wire won't get hot? Or are you saying that you're going to get the heat off the wire?
That's what I'm saying. You can't get...
Okay, all right.
As long as you're taking the heat away from that coil rapidly enough...
Right.
That insulation cannot break down. As long as that insulation doesn't break down, there's nothing to go wrong with that motor.
So the coil is going to produce heat.
Yeah, it's going to produce heat, but it's not going
to... Wait a minute. The coil is going to produce heat, but you're going to devise a way to get the heat off fast enough that it does not destroy the coil, correct?
Exactly.
Okay, exactly. Now, what are we going to do with that heat? We're just going to throw it out in the atmosphere? We're going to blow a lot of air on it. We're going to put it in a bark jacket. What are we going to do with that heat?
Do whatever we want.
Throw it away. No, we're going to use it again somewhere else, another way, differently.
Yep.
Thermal engine, a cold steam turbine, whatever. Come on. Energy cannot be destroyed. It can be used over and over and over again until you do reach a point where, holy cow, am I going to get some naysayers? Over unity. You can use the same energy over and over again. It's just each time you do, you've got to use it differently, and you're going to have to build a device that will do so.
Well, we've sat here with multiple examples of how engines and electronics will destroy themselves because of heat. Now, heat is energy. Nobody in the laws of physics can deny that heat is energy. And it's destructive energy, too. At certain points, yeah, it becomes destructive. And so with that said, you know, we already know we can get work done with heat. All right? We know that. All right? And so with that said, their own laws of physics done said that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. We're just not doing it right. If we're going to build an efficient electric motor, we need to have an electric motor. Why do you think they put little fan blades on the back of electric motors?
To keep the coils cool.
Yeah. But where does that heat go once it comes off of them coils? It just goes out in the atmosphere. It's dumb.
Because we're wasteful.
Yeah.
We throw away. Use it.
So,
I mean, certainly engines. Scott Brown, buddy Mud Band, he has done it over and over. He's built so many Stirling engines, all different sizes, shapes. I mean, there's thousands of videos on YouTube where people building Stirling engines. They're little toys. What happened to the fact that years ago they built real Stirling engines that did real work and they pumped water to irrigate fields? Duh.
Well,
come on, man.
If you can take...
It's there. The technology is there. We've just gotten so modernized, we've forgotten how to use it.
If you can take and make that electric motor basically more efficient by pulling that heat away from it so rapidly without having to add a secondary source. And you don't need a secondary source because enough waste energy is coming off of there to be your secondary source, because you could take that heat and turn it into like a Stirling engine, which would turn a fan, which would then cool it down yet even more. You see what I'm saying?
Buddy, Scott Brown has got a couple of videos on YouTube where he built a Stirling engine, put a fan blade on it, put it on his wood stove that he uses to heat his house. Okay? Now, the thing is, now all of a sudden, the heat is passing through the Stirling engine, turning a fan, blowing the excess heat around and circulating it in the house, making the house more comfortable, but yet he has used the heat to turn that fan, and he has not lost one BTU.
Yeah.
Not one, because it all goes in the house. Even the energy that turned the fan, it had to go through. It had to go through the Stirling engine. And when it came out into the room.
And the crazy thing... The crazy thing about what you just explained, that same heater, the Stirling engine's only using a fraction of that heat.
Exactly.
It's not using all the heat that's lost. There's still tons of lost. And when I say lost, it's lost out into the room, which is heating your house up.
Okay, so now what if he lined the sides of the stove with Pelterial devices? And put that Stirling engine, another Stirling engine, blowing air across them. Now he can also light his home, make his home more comfortable because he's circulating the air, and again, not losing one BTU the energy put off in the house. So, it's every bit of the heat that's coming off his stove is going through the house.
Yep, and then throw another coil of copper tubing around that thing, or even stainless tubing, and circulate water through that. Now you're heating your water for your shower.
Now you hot water, take a shower with, wash dishes, whatever, and he's still got a nice, warm, comfortable house. Come on, man.
That's what I've been talking about. If there
I've been saying over and over again.
If there wasn't no over unity, they wouldn't be afraid of the doggone nuclear power plants. Because a nuclear power plant, when it fails, is usually because it's got too much energy in some section or another. Am I wrong?
You're right.
The too much pressure blows out a gasket, or too much heat causes it to overboil, pressurize, and pow, you know? But if you're taking that energy away so rapidly that it doesn't have the opportunity, you tune it to right where you want it and leave it there, and you don't have to worry about it blowing up. Even a nuclear power plant would be perfectly safe if the doggone thing was made to be more efficient than what it is.
Yes.
We waste more energy than we ever use.
Right.
If you can take an AC, wireless AC tester and put it around a transformer and pick up a frequency out there in the air, why does that frequency have to be that far outside the transformer? All you need is those electrons to dance with each other. You don't need them to be, like, caught on fire or nothing. There's got to be a reason why over in Europe they use 50 hertz and why we use 60 hertz, but their stuff seems to last a bit longer than ours. What's the deal, man?
What gives?
Yeah.
What gives?
So we're going to crank ours up to 60 hertz so we can be wealthy and sell more products.
There you go.
So where's the video for the fume stuff that you're doing, Raymond?
The what?
Yeah, your video link.
Oh, it's, what did I call it? Y'all go ahead and talk. Let me find it.
Alright. So anyway, I guess what I've been trying to point out too, everything that we're doing, heat transfer, magnetic field, the destruction of the magnetic field, it's, you know, you're not literally not destroying the magnetic field. You're just basically shutting it off because you're realigning the materials inside of it, you know, at different temperatures. So
you're not even really shutting it off. You're just disorganizing it.
Yeah.
Like taking a whole bunch of little magnets that were all lined up together and pointing them all in a direction that's counterintuitive to each other so that they're nullifying each other as far as the field effect that you get.
Yeah.
Where, like, we'll grab something. The little magnetic fields, though, are still all there. They're just not doing what you want them to do anymore. That's exactly what I was saying about heat in the air. Particles are basically zipping around at incredibly high speeds in the air that's around you, even in a completely calm room where there's no discernible airflow. You can't feel an airflow, but it's still moving around. But it's all moving in a disorganized manner. You have to find a way to organize that in order to be able to use it.
Nature will always balance itself out. So when you run a magnet across a piece of metal, you align the particles inside that metal, and then whenever you take that magnet away, it will balance itself back out to its natural state. And so
right, it'll go back to whatever shape it fits best together. It's like taking a bunch of cornflakes, throw them in a box. The more you shake them around, the more they're going to pack down because that's the natural state for them to basically fit all closely together.
Okay, I posted a link in the chat room to the video. It's called, in the name of it, it's Increased Fuel Efficiency, number symbol 1. The TK code, number symbol 1. That Increased Fuel Efficiency, number 1. That's the one, first video. And it showed the Peltier devices and the heat transfer muffler that I made for that 6.5 horsepower Honda motor.
Yep, and right now, that's basically in its infant stage as far as being engineered to its fullest extent. But what we've been talking about today is that you don't have to stop there. You know, you can actually keep on engineering this thing so that it's moving the energy where you want it to go. You're literally, with the copper wire, all you're doing is guiding the energy where you want it to go.
Exactly.
And so you're not losing anything. And so, you know, you don't need any outside influence or other power sources in order to get the energy back that you need to take that heat away. You know, once that heat, when you heat something up, heat expands and cold contracts. And so using that bit of knowledge, you can get that heat to do the work that you need to help it cool it back down. That's what heat pumps do. You know, it takes the temperature difference, basically, and expands or compresses the gas and into a liquid form. And then when it expands back out, the temperature changes. It has a cooling effect. That's the same like evaporated cooling. You know, you take a fine mist of water and drop it down. You got a cooling effect going on.
I'm glad you brought that up. How does the evaporative cooler make air cooler? Or how does it cool? Because if you have water at its boiling point, depending on your altitude from sea level, the water boils at 212 degrees. If you're up on a mountain 500 or 600 feet above sea level, it boils at a lesser temperature. Now, here's the secret about evaporative cooling. You can have water at its boiling point, or you can have steam, which is nothing more than vaporized water at its boiling point. Now, the 1 BTU is 1 degree Fahrenheit for 1 pound of water. However, when you reach the boiling point, let's just say, for example, where I live, I'm 350 feet above sea level, so consequently water here boils at somewhere around 208, 209 degrees, a little bit less than sea level. So now let's just say it's 208 degrees, for example. I've got water at 208 degrees, and I have no lid on this water, no way for the steam to turn and make pressure. So if I add more heat, what's going to happen? You think the water's going to get hotter? No, it's at its boiling point. If I add more heat, that heat is going to cause some of that water to turn to steam and just go off into the atmosphere. Now, that steam expands 1,600 times its original size, the water expands, okay? It takes 843 BTUs per pound of water to turn water, a liquid, at its boiling point to steam. There is where you get your evaporative cooling.
Well, there you go,
man. You're drawing the heat, the excess heat, off the water.
So, basically, all we're doing is moving energy, and that's what we've been saying all along.
All we're doing is using energy. We're using it, moving it from one place to another. And once you get it over there, what are you going to do with it? You're going to throw it away like you do with an air conditioning unit. You're taking the heat, the energy, out of the air in your house and putting it outside. You're throwing it away where you can, and I've done it. You can use that energy that you've moved from the inside your house and don't throw it outside, so run it through in a cold steam turbine and make more electricity with it and put that same electricity right back into your air conditioner.
Well, the thing
now,
is,
once you run that energy, that heat, through the cold steam turbine, then you run it through it, you got to get rid of it. Well, what you do is you run that through a Stirling engine, making more electricity. Running that through your air conditioning system.
Well, the thing is, once you get something up to temperature, you get to the point where you don't have to put near the energy in to maintain that temperature.
Right, because once you run that energy through that Stirling engine, you only way you're going to do it is to get it out of the engine. And the best way to do that is, like you said, water jacket. Now all of a sudden you've got hot water to take a shower with.
So
you dropped your energy usage, I mean your cost of energy to run your air conditioner by 60 or 70%, and you also produce hot water, so you wash your dang old filthy dishes and your dirty stinky body.
So basically.
You can't destroy it. You can use it, Once you've used it, what are you going to do with it?
Basically, when you got that water acting all radical because it's all hot and all these water molecules are sitting there trying to figure out where they want to go and align themselves, so bouncing off of each other, all it takes is for you to, like, basically, you know that through two-stage oscillator you made?
Yeah.
Well, you initially had to put a little force to it, but once you got the doggone thing up and running, all you had to do from that point on is just touch with your finger and keep the doggone thing moving.
Exactly.
So, and the same thing would apply in the heating of the water, is as long as you keep those water molecules moving, you don't have to take and use a whole lot of energy in order to keep it maintained once you get it to where the state where you want it.
Exactly.
So, why are we using electricity today the way that we're using it? Why are we still having to try to brute force that interaction when a generator, if it's designed properly, should, once it gets up to its full potential, take less energy in order to be able to use it? And the answer is that we put tons and tons of resistive loads on there, making it demanding more from it than it's capable of producing. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
You don't run 10,000 watts off a 2,500 watt generator, you know? You're asking more than it can give.
Right.
So, with that knowledge, and you got the doggone generator running, it's most efficient, you're taking away any wasted energy from your heat sources or whatever, but you're not dumping it into the atmosphere, you're actually reusing it. That's what your project, in a sense, is actually doing. It's showing you how to get the best efficiency out of that generator because of all the BTUs that you're saving. You know, you're not wasting nothing. So when you start doing the math, the more of these systems that you add to that deal, your math should start looking really good. You see what I mean?
Yep, I do. You know, back years ago, before tractors and all that good stuff, farmers really liked using mules to pull a plow to farm their fields. Why? Because a horse is what they started using because it's bigger than a donkey. I mean, you need four or five donkeys to pull a plow that one horse could pull. So, all of a sudden, accidentally, some male donkey fell in love with a female horse and they had a mule. Well, mules were hybrids, so they couldn't breed. But the mule could pull a plow just as good as a horse, except for one thing. You push the horse, and he's going to go. You push him again, he's going to go. He's going to get tired, you push him, he's going to go. And it doesn't matter how tired he gets, if you push him, he's going to go. Until his heart explodes, and he drops dead.
Yeah, you're demanding more than you can put out.
Will not. He will work. He loves to work. But when he gets tired, he's going to stop. And you can beat him half to death and he still won't go because he knows his limit. Mule is a hybrid. It's a cross between a horse, which is large, heavy, and strong. He's also a cross between a donkey, which is smart, intelligent, and lazy. So you take the best of the two and you put them together. And that's it. Now, let's go the other route. All of a sudden, you've got a female donkey that a male horse falls in love with, and they have a child, and it's called a hinny. And a hinny is totally useless because it takes the worst of both and puts it all into one. Hinnies aren't even worth the oats they eat because their meat is nasty. You can't even eat them. When you have a hybrid, you want to breed it in such a manner that you get the best of both. And that's what a mule is. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. If you're going to use the energy and you're going to demand more that you know that energy can actually produce, I mean, it's, you know, it's just not common sense at all. You know, to make things more efficiently, to get the best use out of what... There is no energy crisis in this world. There's a waste crisis is what's going on. You know, every appliance that we use out here has waste going on with it. For example, if you got a freezer and you got inside that freezer, it's cold enough to keep your food frozen, all right? And actually, freeze will burn your food if it stays in there too long. But regardless of that, put your hand down behind that freezer, and now you got a bunch of heat coming off of there. Right? Well, you got to get that heat away from it so that compressor don't overheat and will, you know, function properly. But that heat essentially is basically heating up whatever room it's in, and now your air conditioner has to work harder. So why not take some of that heat off of the freezer and send it in a direction that you want it to go, where you're still pulling the heat away from the compressor and all the functioning parts in the freezer, and then turning that heat back into a temperature difference that will cause a cooling effect, and use your doggone freezer, if you're going to be running a freezer, to actually cool your house. You see what I'm saying? Temperature and pressure. It's like Justin said, temperature and pressure. That's the key, man. Did I lose you guys again? Doggone it. Hate it when that happens.
Doggone it.
Mm-hmm. So, if you're going to be running the doggone air conditioner for your, keep your cold cool, or your doggone freezer, or even your refrigerator, if you felt the back of your refrigerator, you're going to find out there's a lot of heat being wasted off that refrigerator. It's going right into your kitchen. And your air conditioner has to try to pull that heat out of your kitchen. So, why not design that kitchen to the extent so that all that heat off the back of that refrigerator is vented outside? Now your doggone air conditioner doesn't have to work so hard to cool your house down. But you got an air conditioner running to cool your house down to pull the heat out from inside your house. You got your refrigerator running, which pushing heat back in your house. And then whenever you go to do your cooking, you're doing it in the same room that you're trying to cool, so then your air conditioner has to work even harder to try to cool the doggone house down. Then your kids are flagging the doggone door, so now your air conditioner has to work yet even harder, and your electric bills just keep rising and rising. The hotter it gets outside, the higher your electric bill becomes, because everything that you're doing in your house is counterproductive to what you actually want it to be. That's what I've been saying. So, you take that energy that is wasted off of everything, and you put it where you want it, as opposed to where you just let it go off in the room. I mean, you put your bread in your toaster, and you turn the toaster on, those elements heat up, and that heat's got to go somewhere. It's going out into the room. Your air conditioner's got to compensate for that, too. Your body's 98.6 degrees. You get a crowd of people in your room, even with the air conditioner on, you'll notice it's getting hotter in there. Why is that? Man?
Tell me, Billy Bob.
Yeah, you want it 65 degrees in your house. You want it to be nice and cool and chilly. And you got 100 people in your house, and they're all 98.6 degrees, and you're wondering out why. Your air conditioner.
Take them all out.
Oh, we got to get a new air conditioner. This one ain't working good enough. Oh, man. Make them all hypothermic before you bring them in your house. That way your air conditioner don't have to work so hard. Oh, boy. I love this subject, man. I'm serious. You know, when we talk about alternative energy and green energy and clean renewable energy, this is the conversation that the bigwigs should be having. You know, you got all these doggone appliances out there that say energy saver on them. And their version of energy saving is at a certain point, this thing will literally shut itself off so that it'll save energy. But the same energy saver refrigerator still has that back exposed to the inside of the room right there. So why didn't they take that energy saver to its fullest extent and make something that would take that heat like a dryer vent? Yeah, you take a dryer vent and you normally put it outside the house so that heat doesn't come in the room of your laundry room. It goes outside the house. And of course that's wasted energy. You just wasted it outside the house. And you could take that heat and do something with it. Generate electricity using Peltier elements or thermal couples or thermal piles. Or it's just ludicrous. There's no limitation other than your imagination of how far that you could really expand what Raymond's working on with that motor.
You see what I'm saying? See video, so I can't show you what I'm doing here.
Well, you could verbally explain it.
Maybe not. Basically, I saw his video, and I'm looking at how he can add more surface area on the heat sinks where he's got room to basically expand them.
Yeah.
And redesigning the, like, I didn't see any videos with any actual heat sinks, so I don't know what he has on there. But I guess to go beyond what I've got here, what I would do is I'd basically just use a tree design where the, you know, kind of like you got a Christmas tree that's sticking in a pot down at the bottom.
Yeah.
And then you got, you know, all the branches sticking off the sides up at the top of it going out in all the different directions. Well, just, what the heck? Oh, my video shut off. Just use that tree design where basically the bottom of the tree is pressed up against the Peltiers. And the branches are basically just branches of aluminum sticking off the sides. In more of a T-shape, though. You know, you just basically have a plug at the bottom, a base that's, like your T going up through it. And off of that, you've got a whole bunch of the crossbars that you have at the top of the T.
Yeah.
All the way up along it. That way it can be as tall as, you know, whatever. And that heat is going to go right straight into that stuff. And the airflow is just basically going to pull all that heat off of it.
Well, I got to go.
Basically, if you increase the surface area, instead of each square inch of that thing having to pull, say, 10 or 15 degrees off it, which they have to use a fan to pull it off within, like, you know, 10 or 15 degrees, let's see, 10 or 15 BTUs a second per square inch, you have to have a fan then to blow that air across it because the air just doesn't have the capacity to absorb it naturally that way. So if you increase that by, say, tenfold, then instead of 10 BTUs per square inch, now you're pulling, you know, 1 BTU per square inch.
Yeah.
And the air then might be able to handle that without having to have a, you know, more than 70 watts of electricity running through a fan to blow it over that.
I got a couple questions for you. Most, not all, but most heat sinks that I've ever seen are made out of aluminum. All right? But I have
cheap, and it doesn't oxidize.
Yeah,
copper oxidizes. It's not as cheap, but it's actually a better conductor.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at with the copper portion of it. Copper is a better conductor of heat and electricity than aluminum.
Right. But I'm not sure about the heat, but I know silver is an even better conductor than copper.
Well, that's why they put copper on the bottom of the pan so that it will equally distribute
spread,
the heat.
Yeah, spread it out so you don't get burn spots on your food.
Yeah, so
all the rest of it isn't cooked.
Now, when you talk about like the heat sinks, it's all one solid fin all the way across there. All right, and all those, you know, basically all those solid fins are going to remain pretty much at the same temperature because they're all touching each other. What would stop a person from actually building a heat sink with fibrous material of copper as opposed to, a solid sheet?
Nothing.
There.
Nothing. In fact, I've seen instead of a block where it's basically been milled out with fins in it.
Yeah.
I've seen like a thin block that had a bunch of folded piece of metal that were bolted down to the block to basically create the fins.
So basically,
they were pinched and riveted or whatever, you know.
Basically, by separating those, you have a smaller surface area for the energy to be on. However, you got more of them that are separated so that they're not all touching each other, where that heat is equally distributed from one part of that heat sink to the next. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And so it doesn't take as much to cool down each individual fin. You see
right.
what I mean?
Right. Well, that's the whole point. If you have more surface area, it takes less, conductive power from the air to pull more heat off of it. Because there's more, because all of the air that's around it has the same heat conductivity. You're just increasing the quantity so that you basically got a bigger hole for that stuff to drop through.
Yeah.
Into the air.
The equivalence of just dumping it out into space, basically.
Right, and he's got, the thermal pile itself is basically made out of materials that have metal fused right to it, which is a decent conductor, so pressed up against another decent conductor, and then diffused into the weak conductor of the air, you know, he's basically got everything he needs there, minus basically having something that has more surface area. Just need to increase the surface area.
Yeah,
well, I mean, the aluminum is not that expensive. It's actually fairly cheap, so it shouldn't be that difficult to come up with some material and make some heat sinks for it that would do what he's needing it to do.
Yeah.
So he can actually see a net positive return on his energy
and as,
out of the system.
And as having those, if you had those, even if you made it out of aluminum, if you had it fibrous to the extent to where even the smallest vibration, you know, essentially those little fibers would be wiggling around, and as they're wiggling around, are basically whipping back and forth between the atmosphere. You see what I'm trying to point out here?
Right.
It's
they generate their own air current process.
Yeah.
Instead of moving the air over them, they're moving over the air.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about. And, you know, the temperature difference is going to even help that even better.
Right.
So,
well, the air is going to heat up that touches it, and as soon as it heats up, it's going to move away from the fin, though. So you're not going to need it to wiggle around much if you've got enough surface area. You just need more surface area. If he gets it set up right, he can literally have it run completely without using a fan, pulling enough heat off of that those peltiers so they don't get damaged.
Yeah.
So
that's why I was thinking, you know, he's got a water jacket on the inside of it to keep the temperature of the actual exhaust from actually heating the bottom of the peltier element up too much. Now, if he had a water jacket on the outer side, which was totally separate system.
Just get rid of the water jacket. Build a bigger block that basically is solid aluminum all the way down to that unit so that this is the thing. The heat that's coming out of that pipe is actually radiating out. And if you know anything about square inverse law, you know that basically the more area that heat has to dissipate into before it basically hits your peltier, the weaker it gets. So he's just be able to basically spread that heat out among more peltiers so that no one peltier is receiving more than its breakdown temperature.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And just generate power from all those peltiers then.
Also,
instead of trying to jam it all through a few peltiers and then throwing the excess waste away.
Well, also the key point in that would be that he's trying to make it as compact as possible. With the process that you're talking about, it would be the same. It would work. But
it's not going to be compact.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's going to be possible to do it with the current technology to make it that compact. You're going to have to sacrifice some room in order to basically use this this barbaric technology that we still are using at this point.
I like that word, sacrifice.
Yep. Well, there's a trade-off with everything there, the way that we're running this stuff. You know, we know vaporizing the fuel is going to make it where you don't have to use as much fuel, and you don't waste as much fuel.
But right. Do you have the have an image or something of the Peltiers with the heat sinks on them so we can see the heat sink? Because the video showed me it doesn't have any heat sinks on your Peltiers.
No, the video shows the heat sinks. It does not show the Peltiers. That those black things you're looking at, they are the heat sinks.
Black fins. I didn't see any black fins. I saw a tube with these flat pieces of metal sticking to them that are black.
The black is the heat sinks.
Those are the heat sinks. That's why, then. There ain't hardly any heat sink at all.
Right, exactly.
You need some serious heat sinks. Did you see the thing that's on my screen there?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So you see what I'm talking about. Now, if you move that backing that has the fin sticking out over to the middle and have a fin sticking out of either side instead of just a little short one, I don't think you'd need a fan even on that. So that means all the power that you generate off those peltiers, you get to keep it.
Yeah.
You get to harvest all of it and use it. You don't have to throw it away into a fan to try to keep the peltiers from being damaged.
My idea is fantastic. It really, and it does, what I've done proves that it will work. It's just I didn't use the right things. In other words, the technology is here. It's just I've got to find it.
Well,
right. Well, you just need to use some of that room you got down there in Texas.
Exactly.
You know, build it bigger. You
know, down here one time many years ago, and we were driving around, going around different jobs I had doing at the time, and we crossed a couple of interchanges, highway interchanges, and one of them was State Highway 75, running north and south, crosses 635. And the interchange itself, east and west, is 2.3 miles long. And going north and south on State Highway 75, it's 2.1 miles. And he said, "My God, Raymond, how come they build their interchanges so big?" I said, "Boy, this is Texas. We can." Nobody spends $300 million to build something just simply because they can. I said, think about it. Our interchanges are large. The curvature of the road changing from one highway to the other is so gradual, you can run it at 85 miles an hour without flipping your vehicle.
Easier to merge.
Yes, you don't have to slow down to change from one road to another. Therefore, you don't have traffic jams and backups. I mean, you're from Norfolk, Virginia. Your interchanges are less than a quarter of a mile. Way less. You can measure it in yards, not miles. I mean, so consequently, during rush hour traffic, somebody wants to get off this road and get onto another one. They've got to slow down to 15 miles an hour or they're going to flip their vehicle. So, next thing you know, there's five or six people behind them that are not going to change. They're slowing down. And then behind them is somebody that is going to change. So he's glad to be slowing down, but he's slowing down a quarter of a mile back from where he would normally slow down. No, come on. They build them big so you don't slow down and cause traffic jam. Right. That makes sense. Thank on it.
See, ain't it amazing how life imitates art, man?
Yes.
The art of mad science.
Really?
You know, you got a lot of traffic flow, and so you need a bigger pipe, and that's why they build a bigger road. It's as simple as that. You need a lot of current, so you're gonna need.
When you do something, you always do it so big. Why do you have to build it so big? Well, it's simple. It's really simple. The reason I build it big is number one, because I can. Number two, if my idea is going to work, but I build it small, if I make a tiny little mistake and it doesn't work, how am I going to see it? If I build it big, then that tiny little mistake is bigger and I can spot it. Don't build a toy. Build something big enough that it will, if it's going to work, it will work. If it's not, going to work, but you think it should, then maybe you didn't do it right. Start looking for the mistake. But if you build it big enough, you'll be able to find that kind of big of a mistake.
So there's this thing called a periodic table, and you can learn a lot from a periodic table, such as how many electrons, protons, and neutrons, and the basic makeup of different elements out there. So with that said, there's elements out there that are negatively charged, and there's elements out there that are positively charged. And so what happens when you put the two together? What do you think, man?
Not as exciting as most science fiction nerds would have you believe, because it's not antimatter. Matter.
Well, if you throw lithium into water, if you throw lithium into water, you get a reaction. If you mix spit with aluminum and silver, you get a reaction.
Yeah, you just don't get a warp field.
Did you know that you can clean a coin and generate heat with spit and aluminum foil?
Yeah.
There's a chemical reaction that goes on there. The chemistry of your spit mixed with the metal and the two different dissimilar metals.
It's because your spit's slightly acidic, so.
Yeah. So essentially, you just made the equivalence of a battery, am I wrong?
Yeah, pretty much.
And you're shorting the battery out?
Well, so that's what they're generating heat. Doing to do the plating using different metal, nanoparticle metals for Robert Murray Smith's process, where he's using steel wool to abrase the surface through a gel that has the nanoparticles. He can get that to bond to the metal, even to stainless. And once you get a stripe on that stainless, you can plate anything else you want on it.
I'm going to back out for a minute, go down to the laboratory and check on there. We're working on that vaporized carburetor.
Cool. All right, so anyway, there's a comment. Steven said electric is the interaction discharges between positive, negative, and neutral charge ions, atom, or a molecule within a toroidal magnetic field, the way I see it anyways. What is that? So essentially, we know where the interaction's actually occurring, and we know how to manipulate a magnetic field, at least fluctuate it, kind of like flapping your hand in a pond. You cause waves and it ripples, goes out, and how fast you do that will determine the frequency rate at which that energy is traveling. But nonetheless, you're still doing the exact same thing. You're either throwing nature off balance and nature balances itself back out, and you're catching the energy on the way out, or you're catching the energy on the way back. We know the interactions between heat, cold, heat expanding, cold contracting, and using everything that we've learned in just basic science alone, we should be so much further advanced in society as far as how we use that energy. Phew. So what do you think, man? Do we need a music break?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, so
stop throwing me under that bus.
I had to catch my breath, man. He says, but the wind, Justin, I think that's the one said that, said, but the wind keeps going through his hair. Well, put some heavier duty hairspray on it and freeze it in time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hang upside down when you spray that, maybe you'll get that Einstein look. Or worse.
Or you'll get a new hairdo and look like a cockatoo.
Yeah, that's a spiky kind of deal. Anyway, you're listening to Mad Science. We're going to take a music break and coffee and tea and all that kind of stuff or whatever. So go get your sodies and your refreshments and come back and listen to some more Mad Science in a few. So stay tuned. You're listening to Shaziz Radio. Peace and love, everybody.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
crap! Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
I can describe the ruckus. Yep. And maybe Hank Hill will help me describe the ruckus someday when I get him on the show. But, are you still talking? Anyway, they say for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. I found that out sort of when I was a kid. I had this big heavy-duty black super ball. And I was going to see how far I could slam it up into the air. Well, I took all the force I could muster and I slammed it down. It bounced off the curb and came back up and blacked my eye. Yeah, I had a big old black eye out of that one. But anyway, so, you know, if you go slamming a door, if it wasn't for the latch on that door, the door just stopped where it's at, then that door would bounce back and slam you back. So, basically, energy is going to work in the same kind of way. You know, for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. And the whole point of all this was we weren't never trying to get out more than we put in. We weren't looking for more energy than we put in. When I talk about free energy, I'm not talking about being able to get more than I put in. You know, and with all the things that's going on out there in nature, if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it, because it does exist. You know, when they say, well, you can't do this with a like an electric generator, for example. You start off with a battery, you run in a generator, and then you're going to, or you run an electric motor which turns a generator head, and then you're going to charge that battery back. Well, anybody with any kind of common sense knows that as it stands, that's not possible, because as you're running the juice off that battery into that electric motor, that electric motor takes some energy to produce. The demand to pull that energy back off of that electric motor into the generator and then put it back into the battery to get that thing to self-run is impossible, because you've lost energy from the battery to the electric motor to the generator because of the forces required to put that energy back into that battery. So instead of trying to run it like that, you put a latch in that door. You know, the door don't bounce back in your face. All right, so you take that energy off of that generator, you move it completely away from the generator, so now the generator doesn't require, happen to work harder in order to turn that generator head. Now you still got the same amount of energy that you started with, which can be recirculated right back into that battery. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility to do what it is that they're wanting to do, but you're never going to get out more than you put in. Whatever energy it takes to run that electric motor off of that battery is how much that electric motor is actually going to drain from that battery to put the energy off to the side that you're going to store to put back into the battery at some point. So the whole concept is to get all the work that you can done without having to make that generator work any harder than it has to. You get all the work you want done. That's why everything is the way that it is today, because everything is set up so inefficiently that it won't. It takes more energy to do things, such as just the internal combustion engine by itself. You're using more gas because you're not feeding that fuel to that really incredibly engineered piece of machinery. You're not feeding the fuel in there properly. And the more fuel you put in there, sure, you're getting this thing to run at some serious high RPMs, but the less time that the combustion chamber has for that fuel to finish its burn inside there, the faster that thing's going, the more fuel you're going to waste running it the way that we do right now. That's why they have to have a catalytic converter on there, so that it'll reburn some of that fuel and puts it back into the intake so that you can try to reuse up some of that fuel. But once again, at the same process, you shouldn't need a catalytic converter if you're running that fuel properly. And that's what the project that Raymond's working on. By vaporizing the fuel before he ever even sends it in, he won't have to use as much fuel to get the work done that he wants done. You see what I'm saying? That is the difference. So when I talk about free energy, first off, everybody gets all up in a tizzy over the terminology, and it's not free, man, because you got to pay for this, or you actually got to do work for that. You know, cry me a river. I'm telling you, man. First, you want clean.
And while you're at it, set a hydro turbine on that so you can go ahead and generate power off of those tiers as they flow through it.
Oh yeah, and because there's a little salt additives to your tiers, you could also run that down through a couple dissimilar metals and build you a little chemical battery as it's going through the turbine. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. That was their own law. That's not my law. I didn't write that law. And I didn't make it up. It's there. It says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. However, it can be changed.
So you could technically run fuel your engine of evil off of the tears of the innocent if you got enough of them to make a river.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's enough salt content inside there. You could actually run that through a doggone electrolysis process and produce hydrogen. You know? And all you got to do is keep them sad so they keep on balling, and then you got it made. You know, I'm not trying.
It's so easy when you're evil.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be a jerk. All I'm trying to say is that the way that we use energy is the reason why there's a so-called energy crisis. Why would you need trillions and trillions and trillions of gallons of oil per year or whatever if you was using it properly to begin with? Everything from firewood to oil has multiple uses for every single element out there. You can find multiple uses, repurposing of it. When they very first started doing gasoline, when they first started making gasoline, gasoline was actually a waste product of making kerosene. And they were dumping it down the creek because they didn't want it. It was too volatile to run in an engine at the time or whatever to use for fuel. It, you know, you go to light your lantern and it'll blow up and set fire to your face. And obviously they didn't want to burn down barns back in the day, so, you know, they'd have to be cautious with kerosene, but with gasoline it'd be a little bit more volatile, if you understand what I'm trying to say. But even in those days, if they would have took some time to actually understand the fuel that they were working with, they could have lit things up with gasoline as well, burning off just the vapors alone. You know, could have got a lot of work done with the fumes. So that's the whole deal. That's the reason why we're in the predicament that we are today, that people are out there able to use greed to basically extort nature and people into doing certain things because people don't understand basic science or basic chemistry or any of this stuff. You know, it's simple. You know, gasoline is highly flammable, but it's the fumes that are highly volatile. There's a difference. That's why they tell you when you get out of a car to ground yourself, because a little static discharge at the gas pump could turn out to be really bad. You burst into flames. You know, and there's even stories out there about people spontaneously combusting. You got any thoughts on that for a second, Thomas?
Mm-mm.
Well,
not touching that one with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. If people are sitting
there... Shoot, why don't you start bringing up flat earth theory next?
Well?
You're trying to cause a ruckus here.
Yeah, I'm trying to create a ruckus by simply saying that the human body, there's a fuel source there, right there in itself. I mean, there's water,
Don't start talking about that. They've already got a robot that basically grinds up living tissue and generates power off it. Before you know it, you're going to have the Terminators fueling their power cells off of living human tissue.
That's disgusting, but it's reality. I mean, we get oils from fish and whales and plants and, you know, all of this stuff. There's so much fuel around you, it ain't even funny. You know, during a dry season, it's so easy to start a doggone fire because all the right things are in the right place at the right time, and all you need is a little tiny spark and a little bit of dried... like cedar leaves or whatever. What do they call those little piney things that fall off the side of cedar trees? Thistles or whatever, I don't know. All I can tell you is they're highly flammable. And so once you get cedar ignited, boy, that stuff burns fast. You ever seen how fast a Christmas tree will go up?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. When they're dry, they will burn rapidly. And that's the same thing with any of these.
I don't know anyway. It uses cedar for a Christmas tree, though. Aren't those the ones with the little short, really sharp needles?
Yeah, they call them evergreen trees.
Well, there's a whole bunch of them, though. You got blue spruce and all kinds of different types. Some have real long needles that are kind of flimsy and soft.
Yeah.
Others have those really short ones that are soft. And then there are others that have real short ones that are sharper. Anything. I mean, you grab a hold of those, you better have some Kevlar vesting on to keep from basically getting jabbed to death with
it. Oh, yeah. Don't let them poke you in the eyeball.
Yeah.
But either way, what I'm trying to say as far as kindling, that's some really amazing stuff. I mean, it's so easy to get to burning. There's other woods out there such as locusts, like black locust trees and stuff, the ones with the big old giant thorns on them and stuff, that those and hedge, which some people call Missouri orange, as far as the type of wood that it is, but they have oil inside of them, and that's why they burn so well. But even after burning that, because it burns so hot inside your wood burner, you'll start building up creosote inside the smokestack, and every so often you're supposed to put this special log through there to clean that down so that it don't basically get too hot and catch fire, because once again, after you burn the wood, you still got an extra fuel source going on.
Boom!
Yeah! And it will do that too. It'll look just like a doggone cannon when it gets stopped up like a stuffy nose and builds pressure behind it. You got a problem. And so you just burnt the firewood, you already used the heat once, and on the opposite side you ended up with more fuel. When you burn oxygen, you basically end up with the same element on the other side. You end up with another fuel source. That's it. It's the interaction between all these chemicals, what's going on out there. You're just changing the energy form. You're just changing the material into something. Even wood ash itself. You know, they make all kinds. There's like 10 different things that I had a list on here one time of all the things that you could do with wood ash. From everything from making soap to getting traction in the snow and so on. So, you're not losing nothing. No matter what you do with it, you know, even when you burn off plastic or whatever, melting the plastic down. There's people over in Europe who were taking old plastic deals and turning it back into gasoline, making petrol out of plastic by refining it.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that crazy? So when you're out there running your solar panels and your wind generators and all that kind of stuff, and you notice that there's one particular weakness in the system, such as if they get too hot, they become less efficient, figure out a way to take that waste energy off and bring it back into something usable, and now you don't have to worry about that thing becoming less efficient.
Right.
It's as simple as that. Maybe you'll never get more out than you can put in, but if you can get it down to a sustainable range to where you can actually afford the fuel for it, and if the fuel is already provided by nature, in my honest and humble and unbiased free energy opinion, that's just it, man. It didn't cost me nothing for that river to flow by. It didn't cost me nothing for that wind to blow by. It didn't cost me nothing for the sun to come across there. All I did was let nature do what nature does best, and I got a little bit of work done in the process. You know, you hook a mule to a tractor or a trailer like Raymond was talking about, because the mule is stronger than you, and you let the mule do the walking. So, ain't no different than using nature. If a small windmill ain't going to do it, build a big windmill. You ain't going to take away anything from nature. And if you're worried about the doggone birds flying in between the blades, and put a cage around it. That's what they did to the oscillating fans back in the day when my grandfather had a fan that was built back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that had like a brass blade in it. He always said, "Son, now don't you stick your fingers in that fan. You'll cut them off." Well, apparently somebody must have kept sticking their finger in the fan at some point, so they finally got wise and put a cage around there. So now, even if you want to, you have to force your finger through those fins in order to get it into the fan. It's common sense. Don't stick your finger in the fan. Don't stick your finger in the fire. Don't stick your finger in the light socket.
Don't stick a fork in the light socket while holding on to the other end with your mouth.
Yeah. Do not look into the laser with the remaining eye, like Thomas said. Oh, man. If only we could get the lab of people that understand that sticking your finger in the light socket is not a bright idea. Sticking your finger in the fire is not a bright idea. But using...
I don't know. Those could be bright ideas as you're bursting into flames.
Oh, yeah. We could use you for a temporary light source and a heat source.
Yeah. Wouldn't be a smart idea, but yeah, it would be plenty bright.
Yeah.
Bright flash.
So anyway, we know that things like LEDs use a lot of less energy. So I'm saying that you could literally take a 2,500 watt generator and you could get everything done that's needed to be done in your house off of a 2,500 watt generator. Heating, cooling, and lighting. And warming up your water so you can take a shower. It's not that you're getting out more, it's that you're using it to its fullest extent. We know that LEDs, basically when the electrons interact with the materials inside of the LED, it releases photons of light. And so you get a visible light. And so if you can do this using very little energy in order to be able to light up these LEDs and be able to see in your house like you'd normally see with any other light bulb, but you're using way less energy, that makes common sense. You know, even fluorescent bulbs, the older system, some of them had two ballasts in them where it only took one ballast to run it. And in reality, you didn't even need that one ballast. If you knew enough about how that gas is being energized inside there, you could have done it with a 9-volt battery or less. I mean, it's proven technology. They built a circuit out there with a TIP42C transistor, resistor, and a diode. And basically, it's a fast-acting switch that sends a frequency through that gas that energizes it, which interacts with the material inside that bulb and lights the bulb up. You get visible light. And there's MOSFETs out there, all these fast-acting switches. You could do it by hand if you're fast enough, you know, turning the switch on and off. all it's looking for is the right range at which that gas is going to be energized. You're fluctuating the field, the magnetic field inside there of the electrons of the gas itself. They're bouncing off of each other, you know. If you take and rub your hands together, if they're sweaty, you can rub your hands together a lot longer than you can if your hands are dry. You're going to produce friction, which in turn is going to produce heat, and at some point you're going to burn your hands with your own hands. Does that sound ridiculous? Try it.
Mr. Miyagi.
Well, you think friction burns won't cause blisters? Try it. Try it before you deny it. That's what I'm saying. So it's not that we don't have enough energy, it's that we don't know how to use it properly. And as far as arguing over terminology of how to explain what it actually is, or where it actually comes from, or what it really looks like, and all that kind of stuff, that's a wasted energy. I mean, if you can figure out what it actually is, then you got it made. But in the meantime, using it the way that we want to use it to get things done, heating and cooling and lighting, our best bet is to literally learn how to use it properly and as efficiently as possible. You don't have to build a electric motor that waste a large percentage of it via heat or whatever, when you know that you can take the heat off of that and make that thing last a lot longer. Somebody was brilliant enough to put a fan on the end of that electric motor just to keep that motor cool when it's running at high RPMs for a long time, and so that motor would last longer. Otherwise, without that fan blade at the end of that motor would get hot and burn up and wouldn't last very long. They figured out how to do that, then why couldn't you figure out how to actually take that energy that is increasingly getting higher and higher? It's just like running a high frequency. You're going to keep on getting it higher and higher until it's going to have some sort of breakout, and there's where the cool lightning bolts come off the top of the Tesla coil that all these kids keep playing around with. Same thing with any energy. You keep blowing the balloon up, and the balloon can only hold so much. When it finally pops, it's your face that gets slapped by the retracting rubber. So, there you go, folks. If you want clean, renewable, alternative energy, it's been right there in front of your face all along. You just haven't been using it. You know, you got a gasoline engine that you're pumping a lot of fuel in that's unnecessary, but in the process of doing that, you're generating enough heat that if you take one thing away from that system, that thing will tear itself apart. It will literally freeze up, burn up, lock up, whatever. It'll tear itself apart. And if it ain't balanced properly, the centrifugal force and the vibrations that come with it, it'll vibrate that thing and rattle it loose. You know? Think I'm kidding? Go get you a doggone square wheel and put it on your car and gun the heck of it down a gravel road. Let me know how your teeth fare by the time you get to the other end of that. Your eyes will be crooked and your brain will be wobbling around, and it's not liquefied, jellified.
Take the oil and the water out of your car and run it.
Yeah!
How long that lasts.
Yeah, there you go. So, common sense dictates keep the oil really cool, you keep the water cool, you keep the engine cool, and you recycle every bit of waste energy inside that and use it most efficiently. And then at some point, you got to get rid of that energy. You know, you can't just keep recycling around back and forth, so you got to carry it with you. But, you know, sooner or later, you got to let it go. It ain't yours to keep. Belongs to nature. And so dump it back into nature where it's not going to make nature mad, and your engine won't get tore apart. Because that's exactly what happens. You make nature mad, try to show nature who's the boss. You'll find out. That's all there is to it.
Heat your shower so you can take a water.
Yep.
Paint the lawn. Shave the chicken.
Shave the chicken. Well, chicken's got a lot of energy, man. You know, why don't you, like, build a little dance floor for them, and while you're trying to round them up, they and you stepping on piezoelectrics, which is producing electricity. You can sit there and tap on a piezoelectric speaker and get voltage on your meter. So imagine what those little chicken feet would do running across there. So put some doggone Peltier elements on the floor of your chicken coop, and while they're chasing each other around trying to show each other who's boss, they'll charge up a battery that'll keep the nightlight on for the chicken so they can see the fox or the wolf sneaking up on them. What do you think?
Sounds like a lot of piezoelectric units.
Well, maybe. But it's still a technology that's viable. And you still, you could use it. You thermoelectrics, hydroelectrics, the crystal batteries. You know, once people understand exactly how a crystal battery works, then they can get it, man. Crystal batteries are essentially the same as like how the piezoelectric works. When you have those crystalline structures inside there and they're pushing pressure up against the material inside, have you ever seen one of those crystal batteries after about a year or two that they have them things going that it'll literally split the side of a galvanized metal pipe?
Right.
Yeah, because those crystals are going to keep growing and they're going to keep producing pressure. What did he say? Oh. Anyway, the crystal batteries, they're pretty impressive. And it's just using a little bit of chemistry, a little bit of knowledge on how crystal forms, how they grow, the pressure, and, you know. Some of those guys, like Lind Motor, he's had a little efficient motor running for like 2 years on a crystal battery. That's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Now, you'd have those naysayers out there would say, well, you know, that's kind of cool, but you can't get no work done with it. I mean, hold on a second. Am I blind or something? Work is motion, right? If that thing's still turning.
One form of work.
Yeah. If that thing's still turning, then it's getting work done.
Mm-hmm.
So why couldn't you take and expand on that technology and make it larger? You know, why couldn't you make a giant crystal cell? And actually a renewable giant crystal cell. You know, there's these, this nifty technology out there that they call a vice. It's like really cool new high-tech technology. And you can actually sit there and you can adjust the clamp on that thing to hold something tight while you bang on it from the other end so it keeps the grip.
Right.
So if these crystals are going to continue to grow and you got it in a vise, and as long as it's tight down on there, it's going to produce pressure. When the pressure needs to be relieved a little bit, you just unscrew the vise a hair. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So a couple big giant hydraulic clamps on each side of it, and when the pressure gets to a certain extent, which we have methods by which we can actually measure pressure, and we know that at this certain pressure is when this material is going to give and crack, we can back it off of here with the hydraulics and still maintain enough pressure on there to keep what we want. You see mm-hmm. what I mean? Does that sound plausible? So
plausible.
I'm just saying, man. It's like everything. I think the biggest deal is it's too much effort for anybody. You know, why even bother? You know, if it works, like somebody's always saying, don't reinvent the wheel. The wheel's worked all these years, but, you know, the wheel...
Fix what ain't broken.
Yeah, the wheel in itself was flawed because you can't ride the wheel by itself on a rough surface without some sort of smooth tire in between there. Otherwise, could you imagine the whiplash you could get back in the old wagon train days? Man, bouncing up and down those those rough old trails where the cattle and the horses had done made ruts everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been a rough, nauseating ride after a few miles. And so that's probably why it took them so long to get across the west.
Yeah, they go really slow.
But at some point, somebody thought, well, hey, if I put some of this material in between those wheels, I can get a smoother ride. And if I put these little springy things on there, I can absorb some of that doggone shock. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, where there is a will, there is a way. They say necessity is the mother of invention. And so that's what we need to be doing. Man. It's like, I don't know, man. It's dizzying to think of how far that you could actually take technology if you really paid attention to what's going on there. I'm excited about this project that Raymond's doing because everything we've been saying can be proven with that one experiment that he's doing right there. He came across the point in that experiment where he found a flaw, which is not necessarily a flaw in the system, but he found a point where he had to use an outside fan source to blow across there. But when you went back and looked at the heat sinks that he had on there, you could see right out of the gate that if he had better heat sinks on there, he wouldn't have had to have the fan. You see what I mean?
Right.
So we already troubleshooted that into the next stage of development as far as engineering that thing. And how far could you actually take it? From solid heat sink fins to fibrous type heat sink fins to actually maybe even possibly a water jacket on the opposite side of the doggone heat sink to pull that heat away as rapidly as possible. And so once that's done, now you got to get rid of that heat again. You already got rid of it once or twice. You kind of slowed it down on the inside of his system where he's got the water jacket around the exhaust pipe. And now you're going to be having to slow it down again on the other side by pulling it away from it and figuring out a way to put where to put this doggone energy. We ain't lost nothing yet in this whole process. And that's right. Just one system out of that entire engine. That's not counting the heads, how hot they get. That's not counting the block, how hot it gets. That's not counting the torque that is generated by that engine, which can be doing work on another deal, such as turning a generator head. So you're getting work done all over the place. You're getting waste energy and friction where they classify as losses, I classify as a plus.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point.
Opening in the system.
Yeah.
Put your cup out and you shall receive.
Well, you know, when it's flooding past your house, and that's a lot of power, man. A flood has devastating effects. A tornado, what, 300 mile an hour winds or more, something like that? Hurricanes, mm-hmm. Typhoons, lightning, wind, whatever. The whole deal, the whole planet. You know, what? I don't care whether you think it's flat or whether you think it's round. I don't care about all that. All I care about is it. When you're living in Windy City, you should have windmills. When you're living next to the static capital of the world where it's lightning all the time, then you should be capturing that energy. And if we had a little bit different design on the power grid that we got right now, there wouldn't be no burning of so-called fossil fuels in order to generate electricity. We got enough thermal vents around this planet to take that heat away, boil water, turn it into steam, turn turbines, and even while we're turning those turbines and starting to use that electricity, we got heat coming off of those as well.
Mm-hmm. So are we down to the wire yet?
Wow, we are. Got like 4 minutes. That was like getting exciting. I almost lost track of time. Time flies when you're having fun, man. Anyway.
Especially if you put a propeller in the front of it.
Yeah, in some... In some portions of the alternative energy community, I'm preaching to the choir. In the other portions of the alternative energy, I'm just making people mad. But I'm just going to say it. They said it. I'm saying it. They said energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So where does it go? We're using it. And when you got waste coming out, if you got heat coming out of the exhaust, you got pressure coming out of the exhaust, and ironically enough, you got moisture coming out of the exhaust. Because there's a temperature difference between the atmosphere outside and the temperature of the muffler. You ain't never seen your exhaust dripping water out the back? No? Do you own a car, Thomas?
No, I've seen moisture dripping out of an exhaust. You don't even have to own a car to see that. You can see it in other people's cars while they're sitting there idling it, wasting fuel, sitting on the side of the road.
Yeah.
Parking lot, wherever.
And while they're running their AC, there's water dripping out of that. Heck, while they're burning fuel, they're making fuel, for Pete's sake. That's what I've been trying to say. Anyway, to sum it all up, we started off with some magnets, and we asked the question, what is it that destroying the magnets, and essentially it turned out to be heat. Heat causing the metal to, with the Curie effect, cause the electron shells, or whatever you want to call it, realign, and so it's no longer magnetic. There's a whole bunch of different terminology of all different types of paramagnetic, diamagnetic, and whatever. But the fact is, all we're doing is lining and realigning and throwing nature off of balance, and then nature balances it back out. We're getting work done in between, but right now we're doing it the hard way. You know, don't walk up the escalator with a pogo stick. Just ride the escalator. It's that simple, and it's safer. You ever took a pogo stick up and down an escalator? Thomas?
I've never used a pogo stick, so...
Yeah, well...
Seems kind of like a dangerous thing that doesn't really get a whole lot done.
Common sense went out the window with the invention of the brass knuckles and or pogo stick, or the combination of the two.
And it just kept getting worse till we had a nuclear bomb.
Yep. Yep, that's it. We're going to have the most powerful bomb. We can blow somebody up, and they're still looking for something better than an atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So, how far are they going to waste technology, push it to the extent where they finally mop us off the map, you know? All right, well, anyway, folks, that's it. Mad Science Show's over today. Boo-hoo.
Cry me a river.
Use it for battery technology and hydroelectrics while the river flows. Alright, peace and love, everybody. You've been listening to Mad Science. Stay tuned tomorrow for the Knights of the Round Table. Take care.
Aw, crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.